This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
All right. By the way, most of the prisons we're in are places where people change the rules on us all the time. The world is constantly changing the rules. You think you learned it and you got it down pat and tomorrow it's going to change. And the one place that won't change is God and His Word and His truth. And then the third doctrine, biblical key for grace, is first, sovereignty, second, immutability, and thirdly, the nature of God. 1 John 4:7-8, beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God. Here it comes, for God is love. Generally, in the seminar, I go through that cliched thing about the Greek words for love. And it's been said so often, it's even becoming a cliché to lay people, but sometimes I do it. The different words that are used in the Greek for love. And then I spend some time talking about agape love and the fact that it's disinterested, that it's not connected. If you've read any of the depth psychologists like Karen Horney was a follower of Freud, but changed some of the things that he said significantly. We used to call her Karen Horney, but we stopped doing that when we were corrected quite often by our professors. It was Karen Horney. And Karen Horney says there are two kinds of love in the world, and one is father love. And father love says, if you do what I want you to do, then I will love you. And mother love, and it's not a gender thing, she uses those as labels, mother love says, you can't do anything ever that would cause me not to love you. I have two daughters, and I say this often, and I think one of the reasons they're so secure is because I have said it so often, that there's nothing that they could do that would ever cause me to love them less. If they had been on drugs, I wouldn't have loved them any less than I do right now. If they had become prostitutes, I wouldn't have loved them any less than I love them right now. And I really mean that. And Jesus said, if you then being evil, how much more your Father in heaven. Did I tell you about the lady, the atheist lady who was giving her testimony on a television program? I guess I haven't. I can tell you light up if I've told you before. And so always tell me if I start a story that I've told you before, because I got 10 others that'll fit in that particular slot. But I was in Pittsburgh a good while ago, and in fact, it's been a lot of years ago, and I was, most of the time when I'm in hotel rooms, I pray and fast, and if you believe that, you'll believe anything. But I was channel surfing, going through television, there was a religious program on. I don't generally watch those. The hair's too big, and the people are too straight, and the music's too bad. But by the way, have you been following the statistics on the Omega Factor? Isn't it Omega Factor, the name of that movie? That thing is making big-time bucks. Omega Code, right. Making big-time bucks. It's number 10, and it's drawing more people per theater than any other movie in America. I haven't seen it, but people who know film say it's not that great a film, but it's a whole lot better than one would expect out of the soil from which it grew. It's a film based on that whole idea about the Older Testament, the Hebrew Kabbalah, and how there's a hidden code in all of that. What was that? What was that called? That book, the Bible Code. We interviewed a guy who wanted to believe it on our radio program, and he'd gone through the computers and the statistics, and he said it was nonsense. But at any rate, they get off that idea, and they start talking about how it's in the New Testament. There's this hidden code, and the plot surrounds that. And they say it has mild mystery content to it. It's Christian. There's no profanity, no sexual scenes, but it does have, and it's fairly well done. They said from a cinema standpoint, and it's sort of like the Christian's Blair Witch Project. It's really done very well, you know, and they've done it by promoting it to churches and on the internet and things like that. But at any rate, I'm going, yeah.
My mom saw, though, she said that she didn't even make any sense of someone who wasn't a Christian.
Really? It's that esoteric?
Yeah, because it's like all about, you know, the prophecies and Revelation and that kind of stuff. She said it was a bad movie.
Is that showing here? Is anybody? It is here in Orlando. Where is it showing? Do you know? Oh, is it? No kidding. Hey, I saw a great movie down. Have you all seen Music of the Heart? Go see it. Oh, man. Macho guys like me don't cry. And it was just something in my eye. But I want you to know that that movie absolutely got to me. You guys will love it. If they're showing it in Charlotte. But I'm going to go. I think I'll go over and see that. That's the problem with Christians. We assume things about pagans that generally aren't true. But the interesting thing is that it's making money. It's going to pay for it. They only spent $7 or $8 million to film the thing. Yeah.
Joel Hunter said it was an awful movie.
Did he?
Out, so.
Really?
Yeah,
I've heard that. I've heard that from people. But it's still making money. And we know in America, that's what everything is all about. What I was saying was that I was in this hotel room and I was watching that particular television channel. And there was a lady on the channel, and she was crying, and it was real tears. And I decided I'm going to leave it there for a while, and I'm going to watch it. And she was giving her testimony. She said she grew up in an atheist family. She had never read the Bible ever in her life. She had never prayed a prayer, not even now I lay me down to sleep. Said she had gone to church one time when she was in her early 30s, and it was because she was a tourist in England. And had gone into a cathedral when they were having a service. But she said, other than that, she never had. And then her daughter was hit by an automobile and was in a coma in the hospital. Said that she was, she went to see the doctor and asked about the prognosis of her daughter. And the doctor said, it's not good. She could die tomorrow or she could remain in a vegetative state in this coma for the next 20 years and require total custodial help, care for her. This lady, she's telling her story, says she came out of the hospital room and walked across the street to a bar where she got plastered. And she said she got in a car and she drove home, and she said it was raining. When she drove into the driveway of her house, she could still see the windshield wipers knocking the droplets off the windshield. She said she turned off the car and she said, I began to curse God. And she said, I knew how to curse. And she said, for half an hour, I spewed out all of my hatred and all of my venom at God. And she said, when it was spent, there was silence. And in the silence, there was a voice. And the voice said, that's the first time you've ever spoken to me. And I love you. I every time I think of that story, I get blown away. And I think we need to tell stories like that to our people over and over again. And it's always got to be in the context of people who do not deserve the love that God gives. The issue is not whether or not God exists. I mean, the fool has said in his heart that God doesn't exist. You hear about a young man on an airplane sitting next to the pastor. And the pastor's reading the Bible. The young man said, I don't believe that. Pastor kept reading. He said, did you hear me? I said, I don't believe a word of that. That stuff is ancient. Most of it has been proven untrue. Don't believe a word of it. It's caused more death and destruction in the world than anything that I know. The pastor kept on reading. Young man said, oh man, did you hear me? I don't believe any of that. And then the pastor, with as much tact as one can muster in that kind of situation, looked up, smiled at the young man and said, son, would you go to hell more quietly? did somebody had a question? All right, you know, I can't tell. You guys in Charlotte, if you want to interrupt or say something, you got to kind of shout and I'll get to you, okay? But the point that I'm making is that it's not whether or not God exists. When I did Skeptics Forum in the church by inviting atheists and agnostics to come and meet with me and wouldn't let Christians come. I always won the arguments about the existence of God. I mean, you can dazzle them with the big words if you want to, but there really is logic in the belief that something, somewhere, sometimes started this. You can be a deist and believe he went away on vacation somewhere, but to say that he does not exist, even Bertrand Russell, toward the end of his life on a television talk show, was introduced by the talk host as an atheist. And he said, he stopped him and he said, "Wait just a second." He said, "I never said I was an atheist." And the guy, well, he did, by the way, over and over again. And the guy said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Yes, I just said I wasn't sure." Well, that was Bertrand Russell cramming for finals. As he gets older, he begins to recognize that he's going to go home and face a God who's really there. And if you've got the brains of an amoeba, you can ascertain that a God exists. That's not even the issue. I've only known one atheist in my entire life, and he was a retired PhD in mathematics at the University of Michigan. I played chess with him, and he also was the first homosexual I ever met. And he never made a pass at me. I gave him my chair in a library on a cold winter day, and he was blown away. He looked like Socrates. And so we became friends. And he told me after we had known each other for 6 months, "There are two things that you have to know about me because we're friends, and I want you to know them. I don't want to discuss them. They're not up for debate. I'm not trying to convince you of anything that I believe. But the first is, I'm an atheist. I do not believe there's a God. And secondly, I'm homosexual." I never met a homosexual. I was absolutely, that's the only one I've ever met. I mean, I've seen people that mouthed off the cliches of unbelief, but you can always win the arguments with those. The issue is not whether he's there, it's what is he like? Does he care? People for centuries have looked into the sky and said, "Is there a God?" And once they were satisfied about that, said, "What is he like? Does he care? Is he a child abuser? Does he demand the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Does he care? Does he love? And then does he love me?" And that's the issue, is the nature of God. And the scriptures, because of some of my things, I have a fear of abandonment. My mother often in the middle of the night say she was going to leave. And I had a drunk father and a mother was going to leave. And I knew I wouldn't have anything if she left and I was in serious trouble. And I've always had this fear that people would abandon me, that I would be shamed publicly until I go to him and he tells me that he will never abandon me, first because he is sovereign and second because he's immutable and second and thirdly because of his nature. And the fourth biblical key, this is the quietest class I've ever had on grace. I mean, you guys, I don't know whether things have changed. But feel free to interrupt or disagree. That's cool. I don't speak from Sinai, and this isn't church. So you can talk back if you want to, and feel free to do that at any point. I know, for me too. But what I'm hoping is that you'll talk a little bit, and I won't have to just keep on talking. I don't mind talking. I can do it. But biblical key number four, first, sovereignty. Second, immutability. Thirdly, God's nature. And fourthly is the law of God, Torah, and the importance of it. Psalm 119:97, "Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day." The psalmist says that the law of God is perfect. And I think one of the great dangers that we face as people who teach grace is that we have a tendency to weaken the law and to set it aside or to teach it in an improper way. Matthew 5:17-19 deals with a spurious view that we were before under the law, but now we're under grace, and the law is no longer relevant. "Do not think," Jesus said, "that I came to destroy the law or the prophets." I didn't come to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. "For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." The law never changes. It's magnificent. Do you know, if you talk to an Orthodox rabbi and ask him for the best gift that's ever been given to rabbinical Judaism, he'll tell you it's the law. It's the thing that made them different. It's the thing that reflected God. It's the thing that taught them who they were. It was the thing that allowed them to please the God that they worshiped. And even the law, the Talmud, the law upon the law upon the law, they still consider a gift. Do you ever listen to Laura Schlesinger?
Yeah.
If you were suicidal, would you call her?
No.
Not me, man. I don't need that. I mean, I don't care what I'd done. I ain't calling her. But I like to listen to these idiots. They call her. I mean, they call up and, you know, they're masochists. And they know what she's, unless they're an idiot, they know what she's going to say. But I like her because of her moral stand. And when she went back to her religious faith, she began to practice kosher and to observe the law. Why was that? Because it defined who she is. One of my closest friends in this life is Bill Guralnick, who's head of the American Jewish Committee. And he's going to be coming up and spending a couple of days with us. We'll go out to dinner. And he won't be able to eat. Because he keeps kosher, and because the law defines him, and he's this liberal pinko commie, and yet when he comes to his religion, he absolutely is straight as an arrow, because the law is the most important gift that God has ever given to him. Sometimes we need to recognize that too, but it's a gift to us for some reasons that are very different. Do you know the sermon illustration about the man who goes to heaven? And Peter says to him, you know, in order to get in here, you have to earn 1,000 points. What have you done? He said, well, I've never heard that. No preacher ever said that to me. Peter said, nevertheless, that is the requirement. What have you done to earn your 1,000 points? He said, well, I've always been a good man. He said, when I was a kid, I was a covenant child. I grew up in the church. I had Sunday school pins that went all the way to the floor and across the room. I want you to know I never missed. I was never disobedient in major ways to my parents. I was a leader in high school of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, and I won many people to Christ. I instituted in the school where I was, Meet Me at the Pole. I want you to know I went to a Christian college, and there I studied God's Word. From there, I got a law degree at a Christian law school, and then I defended, with all that I had, the important issues to God's people. And then, he said, I became the president of a bank, and we gave low-interest loans to the poor in our city. He said, I stood on street corners at Christmas for the Salvation Army, and I rang the bell. He said, I have 4 children. He said, 2 boys and 2 girls. The 2 boys are preachers. One of my daughters married a preacher, and the other one is a missionary in a third world country. He said, I've never been unfaithful to my wife. I've never smoked. I've never allowed alcoholic beverages to ever pass these lips. And then turned to St. Peter and said, how am I doing? Peter said, well, that's one point. What else have you done? And he said, oh, God, have mercy. And Peter said, you've got it. Come in. The law has a special working in our lives. And I've told you that the people in Seattle wanted me to do this in the form of an acrostic. And so I'm going to do that for you. The acrostic starts with R, and it's the acrostic is rule. I had to check to make sure. First, the law reveals. What God's will is in the world. Psalm 119, 151. You are near, O Lord, and all your commandments are truth. Concerning your testimonies, I have known of old that you have founded them forever. You know, I have wonderful daughters, and if they had been caught up in my love, and sometimes they were and sometimes they weren't, and wanted to please me, and they were to ask me, Dad, what would you like for me to do? And I would say, well, you better please me, but I'm not going to tell you. What kind of father would I be? The law is the gift both to the old covenant people and to the new covenant people, because it reveals the mind and the heart and the thoughts of a sovereign God. Now, we don't live up to it, but if you want to please the one who loves you that much, then these things are pleasing to him. They're copacetic to him. They're things that he likes. He would rather you be straight than that you be gay in your lifestyle. He would rather you be faithful sexually. He would rather you not steal. He would rather you not kill. And I want you to know, once you move into a relationship with God, a part of that relationship is to know what pleases him. And so the first statement about the law that you need to remember is that it reveals the heart and the mind and the thoughts of God. And then secondly, the law updates. In other words, the law updates you on how you're doing with your walk with God. Psalm 7:9, for the righteous God tests the hearts and minds. Psalm 17:3, you have tested my heart. You have visited me in the night. You have tried me and have found nothing. I have purposed that my mouth shall not transgress. God doesn't test you, by the way, so he'll find out how you're doing. And you know this. God tests you so you can find out how you're doing. He already knows how you're doing. It's this kind of thing. God puts me to the test because he's really not sure how my heart is. And he wants me to show him so he will know whether or not my heart is pure. He knew whether my heart was pure or not before he did it. So obviously the test that God gives us isn't a test. When I was in college, I had a professor that used to give out the exam papers or test papers. And then he would say, I want you to grade them. And then we would wait for him to pass them in. He said, I don't want you to pass them in. That's for your benefit. Now you know how you're doing in this class, and you know whether you need to work a little bit harder or whether you're doing fine. I don't care about the grades that you made on the test. Well, God sort of says that too, something quite similar. He says, the test is for you. And the great thing about the law is that it's self-grading, and that I can measure how I'm doing with him. And then thirdly, and I've said that, by the way, I've said before, that the reason I teach grace is because I need so much of it. Whenever I say to lay people, I say, you know, I really do bad stuff. And they always say, oh, Steve, you're so humble and so vulnerable. And I'm glad they say that because I need the job. But the truth is, what I said at the beginning is absolutely true. The reason I teach grace, and because I'm a radical grace teacher, is because I need grace so very much. But let me tell you something. You never met anybody who wanted to be obedient to God more than I do. You've just never met anybody who had a heart wanting to please God more than I do. And I'm so grateful for the law. We have a confession, a Reformation confession that Reggie sometimes uses in the chapel here. And it goes through the Ten Commandments. It's not the hymn we sing. It's a confession. I forget which of the reformers wrote it. But where we examine ourselves according to each of the Ten Commandments. And you go through each of them. I took that down from our little chapel thing 5 years ago. And I've used it in my own devotions often. I'm so glad for it. See, I don't have to pretend to be good to God anymore. I don't have to pretend to be good to you. That's not, you know, it's cool. We already have discovered what I am, and I know what you are. You're a sinner, and if you weren't a bad sinner, Jesus wouldn't have had to die for you. So that means you're bad folks, and that means I'm bad folk too. And so that's not even the issue anymore. But I want you to know, in my heart, I want to please him so much, I can't tell you. When I confess my sins in the morning, I say, oh God, I can't believe that. And I was going to do so much better. But I'm so glad that I have an absolute standard whereby I know how I'm doing. The law updates. The law lectures. Galatians 3:24 is true before you became a Christian and after you became a Christian. Therefore, the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ that we might be justified by faith. The law is the teacher that drives me to the throne of grace. The law is the teacher that keeps me in his grace. Do you know the purpose of guilt in your life? Is it so that you can remedy yourself? No, you tried that. You couldn't do it anyway. Is the purpose of guilt in your life to keep you feeling like a worm? No, you're valuable. You're very valuable to God, and that's where your good self-image comes from. What is the purpose of guilt? The only purpose for guilt for the believer is to drive us to Jesus. That's all. Once it's done that, it's done all that it can do. And so the law does that. It increases our guilt, and we say, I've got to run to him again. I run to him, and in the places where I've been successful or where his grace has been successful in me, to love people I didn't love before, to be more faithful than I'd been before, then I know he did it because I know me. And in the places where I didn't do it, I run to him and I get hugged. I can't believe that either. In both ways, God gets the praise for what I'm doing. But the law becomes the tutor that sends me to him. Fourthly, the law educates. Psalm 119 97 through 98. In fact, the whole 119th Psalm. Oh, how I love your law. It is my meditation all the day. You, through your commandments, make me wiser than any of my enemies. Max Weber, the economist, makes a good point about the economic change that took place after the Reformation. And it took place because of the Protestant work ethic. What was the Protestant work ethic? The Protestant work ethic was no more or no less than the law of God applied to the people of God that they could live in the world of God. And as they did that, then things were better. Manfred George Gutsky, who's dead now, who was a friend of mine, I used to love for him to come to our church. He had eyebrows that literally stuck out to ear. And if any of you are old enough to remember him, he was one of the great earthy Bible teachers in the church. He taught at Columbia Seminary, and he was the mentor to Ben Hayden and a lot of other guys, older guys, in our denomination. And Gutsky had his Ph.D. from Columbia, and he was a very, very earthy guy, and I loved to have him come. But he said to our people one time, and I know that everybody else had heard it 1,000 times, but I never thought of it before. He was doing an exposition on that text I read to you where Jesus said, I didn't come to destroy the law. And he said he didn't come to destroy it. He came to fulfill it. How he fulfills it is by giving God's people the knowledge of how best to live in the world, to be as happy as they possibly can in a fallen world, to be as successful as they possibly can in a fallen world, and to be as peaceful as they possibly can in a fallen world. And then he said something, and we had a lot of pagans in that church at that time. He said, some of you are unbelievers. He said, don't just tune me out. This is good for you too. Insofar as you do the stuff that God says, then you're going to be as happy as you possibly can, and you're going to be as peaceful as you possibly can, and you're going to be as successful as you possibly can, because this is the way the world works. I remember a young man in Miami who was going to Florida International University, and he was elected president of student government. And I mean, he was a strong Christian. I said, man, I'm so proud of you. He said, oh, it's not nothing. He said, they're so bad and are so dumb that all you got to do is be a little light and they notice you and you get promoted. Listen, the truth is Christians, that's why I go batty when I see Christians who to the world are these. I was listening to the Phillips file. Do anybody listen to that on FM? Yeah, okay. I was listening to it coming in. I think he's a good talker. I think he's shallow. But I think he's a good talker. So I was listening to Phillips, and I like that sometimes. But don't tell people. But I was listening to it, and he was talking about books that couldn't be read. Talking about those new books by that guy that has the witches in his book.
Harry Potter.
We've been trying to get him on our program, and it's hard to get that guy. He's gotten so famous and rich.
Sure, that may be the problem. It's a woman.
Is it a woman? Well, I didn't even, I thought it was a man. I don't even know his name. Her name.
It's a woman is the writer.
Is a woman the writer of this?
Yeah.
But it's about a boy, right?
Right.
I don't know a thing about him, but Aaron keeps telling me he's trying to get whoever the author is. Okay. I just assumed it was a guy. Is that sexist or what? It's not better than I was. I mean, I could have been a lot worse. I just want you to know.
You are doing better.
But anyway, they were talking about those books. And a Christian called up. And the Christian started saying, you're going to rule the Bible out of public schools, and started doing it. I couldn't listen. I just couldn't listen. I had to turn it off. I said, oh, what's that person doing? That person shouldn't be that way. That person should be the most balanced, the most together, the wisest, the most profound caller that Phillips ever gets. Whenever you see the weirdness taking place in the body of Christ, it didn't come from God. God didn't sell that stuff at his church. At his store. That's why the law is there. The law, if people understand it properly, make us wiser than pagans. Makes us more balanced than pagans. Makes us more successful than pagans. More together than pagans.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit, towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.